You may be seated.
Our next case is 2017-1088, Disciplinary Counsel versus Quentin Martin Derryberry II. Mr. Derryberry?
Chief Justice O'Connor and Honorable Justices, my name is Quentin Derryberry II. I'm the respondent attorney appearing pro se in before this court. This case has evolved from an engagement which in which I was engaged as counsel to represent and advise a Linda Moore of Lima, Ohio, in a matter pertaining to a perceived custody issue pertaining to her great-grandson, Deacon Smith, who is the young son of Ms. Moore's granddaughter, Megan Engel. The engagement commenced actually almost 4 years ago, met with Ms. Moore on October the 29th of 1913, and that engagement terminated approximately 35 calendar days later on December the 3rd, when Ms. Moore came to my office and discharged me. Without getting into facts, which have been covered and I'm sure the court has become familiar with through the pleadings, the custody issue with a great-grandmother and a grandmother, mother, father, and a total of four children in four separate juvenile court paternity cases. Ms. Moore filed a grievance against me on March 19, 2014. I distinctly recall, unfortunately, that I was extremely offended personally, professionally, and regrettably angry that she was claiming, appeared to be claiming, in essence, that I had failed her legally and that I had caused her to lose custody of, or fail to gain custody of, her grandchild because I had not pled her position within the time frame that she apparently believed it needed to be, or should be, or she wanted it to be.
Counsel, did you ever file anything on her behalf?
Ma'am, no. Filing on her behalf would have taken place on right after December the 2nd. I was, and of course there's a question that she did not understand that I failed to communicate, to file the motion to intervene and the motion in the case as soon as her daughter, her granddaughter, who was her ally and the child's mother, was served with summons. Until that time, the mother was not really subject to the court because she had not been served with the pleadings. And with it being a non-parent, not only a non-parent, but not only a grandmother, but a great-grandmother, it was obviously necessary that there be an allegation of parental neglect, unfitness, whatever. And Ms. Moore did not obviously want to make that allegation against her granddaughter, who was her ally and who's the one who had actually placed the child with her in the first place. So the intent was to file the documentation scheduled to file as soon as her granddaughter, Megan Smith, was served with summons, which occurred on December the 2nd. quite frankly, when Ms. Moore came to my office and dismissed me, I was totally surprised and totally flabbergasted.
Well, let me ask you, were there attempts to contact you by your client before you were discharged?
I'm sorry, before?
Before you were discharged, were there attempts to contact you by this client? Did she call your office? Did she appear at your office? Did she talk to your assistant? Did she ask you to call her?
The testimony is by my assistant, who I consider very competent and very experienced, was that Ms. Moore came to the office on several occasions, but there was no conversation. It was just general, what is happening? When is this going to go on? There's dispute as to between actually my secretary and Ms. Moore as to whether or not there were calls or when there were calls or when she came in. I would point out that there were actually 23 working days from the day that Ms. Moore first came in until the day that I was discharged.
Well, the factual finding was that she left at least 8 voicemail messages with her name and telephone number requesting an update on the status, and that none of her phone calls were returned. Is that not true?
I have no knowledge of her calling during this period of time. I have knowledge from my secretary that she came into the office. One of the times she came into the office in this 23 working day period, I was there when she came, and I met with her when she dropped in and further discussed the case. And
counsel, will you step up and talk into the microphone?
I'm very sorry. Do I need to repeat what I said?
It'd probably be a good idea.
Okay, that on one of the several days that Ms. Ziegler testified that Ms. Moore simply came into the office, which was perfectly okay, that I was in the office and was available to talk to her, I did stop, meet with her for a period of time, and we've had very congenial conversation.
I've never had conversations with her during this month?
Yes, ma'am.
You saw her in your office?
Yes, ma'am, which she denies, which both my secretary testifies affirmatively that she did, and I, of course, am telling you now that I met with her.
Okay, let me ask another question here. During this, when this case was filed, did Melissa Sharp file documents indicating that she wanted to obtain legal custody of this child?
Yes, ma'am. She had filed a motion to intervene, which a period of 14 days passed on under motion rule before the court granted that motion to intervene, at which time she filed a complaint and summons, which was served on the child's mother on December the 2nd.
And that's what got this case moving?
That is the time that the case would start moving, yes,
and
ma'am.
And where was the child at this time?
With Ms. Moore.
Okay, and so the former daughter-in-law files a motion to take the child out of Ms. Moore's home and filed the complaint to do that, correct?
Yes, ma'am. It was obvious from what she filed.
And you wanted to wait until the granddaughter was served before you filed a motion to intervene?
Yes, ma'am.
Why is that?
Because in my evaluation of the situation, the rather disconfirmated four children, mom, dad, grandmothers, everything else, to have an organized, that in this case, pertaining to the one child only that Ms. Moore had expressed an interest in, that once the daughter was served, that it was then time. Until that time, until the daughter was served, there was really no action, and essentially no action pending. until service, and essentially to have filed anything previously would constitute that Ms. Moore was asking the court to grant her custody from the daughter, which actually, obviously that was ultimately the situation, but as opposed to the grandmother. And parenthetically, there's nothing in the record that indicates that any action or lack of action on my part in any way prejudiced or affected Ms. Moore's legal position.
Counsel, as I understand your position, over here, this way.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. As I understand your position, it's that it was a matter of strategy, that you did intend to file, you didn't file at the time that your client wanted, because you had a strategic reason for doing that. What you appear to concede is that you could have communicated that better to your client. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me one moment, please. I readily, humbly, openly concede that I could have handled everything better. In the period of time, it comes back to, and I think I made reference at one time to the paraphrased version of the scripture from Proverbs, that pride goeth before the fall. When that complaint was filed, in a case that I frankly thought I had given very careful evaluation of, frankly thought that had been communicated and understood by Ms. Moore, however, acknowledged that I apparently was wrong, I felt in the complaint that she filed originally with Allen County Bar Association, that I was being accused of, well, she didn't, never mind malpractice, that I was being accused of being the cause that she lost custody of the child, when I vehemently say that is not the case, yet I admit that I was hurt, I was angered, I handled it wrong. I reacted to that. As I say, I'd had no indication that she was upset with me or anything until the day that she came
Counsel, on December 2nd, Moore accompanied Engel to a scheduled pretrial conference relating to Sharp's petition to be designated as the temporary residential parent and legal custodian for Cyrus and Rain.
This is correct, of which Ms.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
And the mother was there.
Yes, ma'am.
The granddaughter. And Moore went there, and that's when she found out that you had done no filings, correct?
I'm sorry, that I'd found out that
you had filed nothing December 2nd.
She found out?
She found out December 2nd that you had filed nothing in the case related to Deacon.
Well, apparently it came to her attention, however, yes, I do believe that's when she realized that, but that was true the day before, and probably the day after. It would have been a couple of days. I had expected to meet with her and with the daughter after she was served, and then to proceed with filing, as indicated, strategic timing of the filing to assist in setting this case, this child, apart from the fracas that was going on with the others.
That the child's grandmother, Melissa Sharp, filed for custody? When did you learn that?
Well, she filed the summons and complaint on November the 14th, and I learned it soon after it, within a day or so.
Knew that there was a complaint pending.
Yes, sir, that had not been served.
Custody of the child that your client wanted custody of, and yet you filed nothing. Have I got that right?
I had filed nothing.
Okay, so the court never knew that your client was interested in the custody of this child. And the only thing before the tribunal then would have been the opposing, I guess it was the grandmother's motion, for custody of the child. And you waited and never filed anything. Have I got that right?
I intentionally, strategically waited that, and until the mother was served with the complaint.
I understand you've said that several times, but
we had time to file. We were then responding to a complaint that had alleged.
You weren't answering a complaint. You were going to file an affirmative motion for custody.
Your Honor, in all due respect, she effectively had custody. The daughter, the child's mother, had full custody, period. So until there was anything done that disturbed that, the placement of the child with the great-grandmother, as I indicated in the evidence and the stipulations and so on, the Allen County Children's Services Board had investigated. They approved of the placement with the grandmother, great-grandmother.
Did you know that the grandmother, Melissa Sharp, had custody of the other two children?
Had two, and there was a fourth one that was still with the mother. There were a total of four children.
You knew that Sharp had custody of the other children?
I knew that they were living with her and that she was seeking custody of them. It had not been granted. The whole custody issue was not concluded in this case until almost a year later. It was late November of 2014 before custody award was made as to any of the children.
What was the engagement letter that you entered into then with Linda Moore, your client? What was the purpose of that engagement?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, as I have conceded in pleadings, I did not have an engagement letter. My conversation, which I recognize as being a fault, and I take full culpability for that, the conversation, the relationship, the engagement was very cordial.
What I'm trying to focus you on is, what was the purpose that you accepted a $1,000 retainer? What were you going to do for the $1,000? What was the nature of the legal work you were undertaking on behalf of Mrs. Moore?
Investigate four case files that were pending in the Auglaize County Juvenile Court pertaining to the children, the prior positions of the parents, the mother and father who did not live together, who were not married, but all four did have the same mother and father, to get a perspective of all of these issues, to discuss them with my client, which I did, and to discuss with the child's mother by telephone, who lived in Indiana, which I did, to discuss with the Children's Services Agency in Indiana, where she lived, who had made a report, and which I did, to go into this situation involving a child's custody.
You don't acknowledge that you were retained to obtain custody of Deacon for Mrs. Moore?
To the extent that it was actually threatened. An intent had been evidenced by the fact that a motion to intervene and then a complaint had been filed, even though it had not been served.
Counsel, you said you didn't do anything until November 14th. That was when you had your agreement with your client?
I'm sorry, was...
November 14th, I think I heard you say, is when you had the agreement to represent your client here.
No, ma'am. It was October the 29th.
Okay. This was a hearing between the mother and father, and then the grandmother intervened in that and made the application for the two boys, Rain and I forget what his other name was, or the other one's name was, oh, Cyrus, and also Deacon. She wanted all three boys in her motion to intervene.
The first two boys, all of that...
I know she had them already, but she didn't have a court order for them. And she wanted Deacon, and Deacon was placed with your client by the mother, correct?
Deacon had been with my client for approximately 2 years, according
to
her.
By the mother,
yes.
Not court, by the mother.
Had custody.
And so by the time they have this pretrial, December 2nd of 2013, you still haven't filed anything on behalf of your client. Correct?
That is correct.
Your client knew about the pretrial. She attended the pretrial.
The pretrial had absolutely nothing to do with Deacon. Absolutely nothing to do with Deacon.
I understand that, but you knew about that.
And I had discussed that with her.
All right. By December 18th, Deacon's taken out of your client's home.
Because... when I was discharged on December the 2nd, there's a 14-day period to which a motion can be responded. The complaint had just been filed. It would not have been set for any consideration for the 28-day period. The Ms. Moore's motion complaint would have been filed on December the 3rd, 4th, 5th, right in there afterwards, so that it was an orderly procedure, as I see it, for the sake of her concerns, for the sake of the child, and to keep the case pertaining to Deacon, who was her only concern, as far afield of the fracas of the other three children as possible. It was a professional evaluation and consideration.
She engaged you in order to get her legal custody of Deacon. Is that fair to say?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So you didn't have to wait for anything. You could have filed that complaint to have Deacon, and you could have had the mother's affidavit acquiescing it, correct?
I could have. It took quite some time to receive the documents that were faxed to me, to review the four court files.
What did you say?
It took a time. It didn't happen on one day. That the documents that the mother had received from the court, so I could see what that position was, then to go to the court and to retrieve each of the four pending separate paternity cases, looking at the history of what had gone on, who was on first, if you will, who had custody, who had filed what. Again, ma'am, it was my...
Did you go to court and review the docket?
Absolutely.
Figure this all out?
Yes, ma'am.
And when did you do that?
Within the first week after I'd met with Ms. Moore, after...
So you knew what the lay of the land was?
Yes, ma'am.
Who had the children, what was necessary to be done, and you knew that your client wanted legal custody of Deacon?
Yes, ma'am, and she came to me for advice, which I gave her and which I believe was correct.
Well, not only advice, she engaged you to do a job.
And
paid you to do a job.
Yes, ma'am, which would have been done right after the service of process on...
Service of process for what? What was filed that you had to wait for a service of process?
Until Megan Engel was served with process. She was the undisturbed, full custodial parent of Deacon.
Now, are you saying based on the grandmother's filing, you were waiting for that to be served on
yes,
the mother?
Ma'am. Yes, ma'am, absolutely.
And when did the grandmother do that filing?
On the 14th of November.
14th of November?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's 2+ weeks after your client engaged you to file a complaint for custody of Deacon.
Yes, ma'am. Her concern, though, was not that she, quote unquote, obtained custody per se. Her quote was that Ms. Sharp, the grandmother, her ex-daughter-in-law, was not able to take custody from the child's mother because her arrangement with the child's mother, sanctioned by the Children's Services Bureau, was quite satisfactory. She wasn't looking for custody for the sake of having custody. She was wanting to prevent child's grandmother from taking custody from the mother, which would of necessity taken the mother out of control and her inability to.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Are there other questions? May I get a drink of water?
You can sit down now, counsel. Mr. Drexel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Scott Drexel. I'm the disciplinary counsel appearing for a relator in this case. This case rests upon the credibility determinations of the hearing panel who heard and saw both the respondent and the grievant, Linda Moore. This court has consistently held that it will defer to the hearing panel's credibility determinations and to their findings of fact unless the record weighs heavily against those findings. In fact, the record of the proceeding here fully supports the findings and credibility determinations of the hearing panel and the board. The hearing panel specifically found in paragraph 29 of its report that Linda Moore was a very credible witness. It also specifically found in paragraph 30 of its report that respondent's version of events was not credible. What it found to be not credible in particular was the respondent's testimony and allegation that he had fully explained the situation to his tactical strategy of delaying any filing to Ms. Moore and that she had accepted that determination. In fact, the hearing panel found that he had never communicated that strategy to Ms. Moore and that his testimony that he had was an effort on his part to simply justify his delay and to cover up the fact that he had not taken any action on her behalf. Interestingly, Mr. Derryberry has not objected to the findings of the hearing panel, except with respect to this one issue as to whether he had a viable strategy of waiting. And so he's essentially asserting that there was insufficient evidence to support the finding that, or the conclusion that he violated Rule 1.3 by not taking any action on Ms. Moore's behalf. But he's not objected to the findings of the hearing panel or the board that he made misrepresentations to the relator and to the office and to the hearing panel itself during the course of this proceeding. His testimony as to the version of events was starkly in contrast to Linda Moore's. Ms. Moore testified that she had only 2 meetings with the respondent. She came in to hire him on October 29th, and they spent an hour discussing her desire to obtain an order giving legal custody to Ms. Moore of her great-grandson, Deacon.
Was it to obtain custody for Ms. Moore, or was it to ensure that Ms. Sharp not get custody?
It was to get it for Ms. Moore. She wanted temporary legal custody of her great-grandson. Mr. Derryberry had told Ms. Moore that he needed information about Deacon, where he had resided, his school experience, his grades, other information to show that it was a proper placement with Ms. Moore. She came back 2 days later with all that information and provided it to Mr. Derryberry. While Ms. Moore was in the law office with him, he called the mother, Megan Engel, the mother of Deacon, and talked to her and asked her to provide him with documents that she had received relating to the custody of all the children. The panel found, and Ms. Moore testified, that her granddaughter had faxed that information to Mr. Derryberry the next day, so that would have been November the 1st. Included in that information, and this was the impetus for her to come to Mr. Derryberry's office in the first place, was a copy of a motion to intervene that had been filed by Melissa Sharp, specifically with respect to Deacon, that had been filed with the Auglaize Juvenile Court. Attached to that motion to intervene was an affidavit in which Ms. Sharp indicated her intent to seek custody of her great-grandson.
Counsel, if I may,
yes, sir.
Like you to address the respondent's suggestion that his actions or inactions had no effect on the outcome of the custody of this child.
Well, if he had filed the motion to intervene, perhaps that's true. But his lack of taking any steps to do that resulted in the court granting custody to Ms. Sharp.
Did the great-grandmother hire subsequent counsel?
She did not. It's really not part of the record, but she had decided after she terminated Mr. Derryberry, and she turned over custody of Deacon to the grandmother, that it would be disruptive of his life and the family's life to try to change that result. So she did not. But she was very strongly desired to have a order of custody, something that Deacon also wanted and that Megan Engel also was.
How old was he at that time?
He was 7 years old at that time. So the hearing panel in this case and the board adopted these findings, specifically found that Mr. Derryberry made at least three misrepresentations to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel and to the hearing panel in connection with this matter. Number one, that he had told Ms. Moore about his strategy, which they found was not credible. They also had found that her conduct was consistent throughout with her expectation and belief and understanding that Mr. Derryberry intended to immediately take action to file for custody. That's why she called eight times and left voicemail messages that weren't returned. That's why she spoke to Mr. Derryberry's secretary and asked him to call back, and he failed to call back. When she went to the hearing for one of her other great-grandchildren, or two of her other great-grandchildren, and she discovered that he had not filed anything, she spoke to the attorney for the Melissa Sharp and asked if he had heard from Mr. Derryberry, and he said no, he had not. And that obviously made her angry. She went to the clerk's office and was told by the clerk that nothing had been filed on her behalf. And so she went to Mr. Derryberry's office and terminated him. She denies that she had any contact with Mr. Derryberry after the second meeting on October the 31st, and the findings of the hearing panel and the board support that version of the events. The second lie that Mr. Derryberry told was that he had provided an invoice to Ms. Moore when she demanded a refund of her money because he had not done anything in her view on her behalf. He gave a partial refund and sent an invoice for identifying things that he had done on her behalf. And one of those related to a telephone conference that he had purportedly had with the attorney for Melissa Sharp. So during the course of the investigation, we asked him when that call occurred, because Mr. Dairy Berry's invoice did not break down the tasks by the date that they occurred. It was just a kind of a lump billing in which it just mentioned a number of things he'd done without giving a date. So he was asked when that occurred and what the subject of the discussion was. It took some prodding to get him to respond, but he ultimately said that they basically discussed the whole family situation and what was to be done. Mr. Kentner, the attorney, denied that he had had any conversation at all with Mr. Dairy Berry. And then Mr. Dairy Berry at the hearing admitted that he actually didn't have any conversation with Mr. Kentner, that he merely tried to call him, and that was what he intended to tell him, but he never had that conversation, and he was unable to leave a voicemail message for Mr. Kentner because he either didn't have voicemail or the voicemail didn't work. Mr. Kentner says he does have voicemail. He never received any call from him. Obviously, Mr. Derryberry's version at the hearing was different from what he said in his responses to the relator. And then at the hearing, he also denied, even though there was documentary evidence to support it, he denied that he ever told relator that he had talked to Mr. Kentner. So those three things the hearing panel found were material misrepresentations of fact, and for which they found him culpable of a violation of Rule 8.1A. Based upon that, and the lack of any mitigating circumstances, the presence of three aggravating circumstances, including a record of prior discipline, multiple offenses, and his refusal to acknowledge any wrongdoing in the case, and in light of the case law, the hearing panel and the board recommended a one-year suspension with 6 months of that suspension stayed. We submit that that's entirely consistent with the case law that was cited by the hearing panel, and that that's the appropriate degree of discipline to be imposed in this case.
Counsel, the concern that I have with your statement that he refuses to acknowledge any wrongdoing, here what we're talking about, substantially what we're talking about is a difference in strategy. So under those circumstances where he thinks he had a strategy, he admits, I didn't communicate it well, but I had a strategy and I was going to file at a later time, why under those circumstances would anybody say, okay, I was wrong, now I will acknowledge wrongdoing, if it's a question of strategy?
Well, he does not acknowledge that he failed to return telephone messages and calls. Even his secretary, Ms. Ziegler, testified that Ms. Moore called frequently. He has never testified that he returned a single one of those calls. His position throughout this, he even acknowledged that he could have filed the motion to intervene and to seek custody at any time. Even though the hearing panel found that it was that there may have been some practical basis for such a strategy, there's nothing to be gained by that strategy, and especially in light of the fact that he knew that Ms. Moore expected and wanted.
We can't just defer to the hearing panel when you like their findings and not when they don't. I mean, they did make a finding that there could have been a plausible strategy, right?
They said it might have been a plausible strategy, but what they said was it was never communicated to Ms. Moore.
So the issue that they relied on was the communication, not the failure to file. Right, and that's I read that report, and it seems at odds with what you're saying here.
Well, what they found was that time was of the essence from Ms. Moore's standpoint, that she expected and understood, based upon her communications with him, that he would take action, and that he did not do so over that next 35 or 40 days. So would he have later? I mean, he says he would have, but. But we don't have any evidence other than his own testimony
done. What the panel found, though. I mean, are you asking us to ignore that about the strategy?
I don't think they found it was a plausible strategy. What they said was it might have been a plausible strategy. But I think what they found was that he made that up as an excuse for his lack of action, because that's what they found was not credible, that this was his reason for not acting, and they specifically found that not to be credible.
And did right. you say and I guess my problem is you're asking us to impose a punishment really for a different basis than what the hearing panel said. I mean, we can quibble about the statement, but I'll pull it up here. It's pretty clear what the basis is. The hearing panel, let me find a paragraph here.
It's on page 10, Ben.
It's paragraph 10. And I'm
paragraph 10 or page 10, I'm sorry.
It's page 10.
Paragraph 10 is paragraph 30, page 7.
We recognize that delaying the filing of custody papers until after Sharp was granted leave to intervene and move for custody might be a plausible strategy. So I don't know, in light of that finding, or that at least it could be a plausible strategy, that we should be imposing discipline because we don't like his trial strategy.
Well, Your Honor,
I don't know
I think
that you should be arguing that.
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at the next sentence of the finding, too. It says, however, we find that respondents can...
Correct. So the issue is the failure to inform, not the trial strategy itself.
It says, we conclude that respondent falsely represented to relator that he communicated this strategy as a way to justify his failure to promptly pursue her desire
I understand
custody.
That. I read both of those, but I... Right. I guess my problem is I keep hearing you arguing that we should impose discipline based on those things, but also upon the trial strategy, which seems to be off the table. You haven't filed there's no objection to this report.
Well, Your Honor, I think the gravamen of this finding is that they didn't believe that that was his strategy and that that was something he claimed after the fact to justify his delay.
Where do you get that? I mean,
well, this paragraph sentence that says he did it as a way to justify his failure to pursue the matter on behalf of Ms. Moore.
No, it says that he falsely represented that he communicated the strategy. That's different than what you just said.
Well, I understand we might disagree, but I think the finding here is that this was an excuse that he had after the fact to justify the fact that he didn't take any action.
It doesn't say that, but it doesn't even come close to saying that.
Your Honor, it says that
he falsely represented as a way to justify his failure. So what they said was the false representation was a way to justify his failure.
The false representation
that he communicated this with her. That's what it says. It's the only thing it says.
Okay, I accept your explanation. I think what the panel was saying was something different. But I recognize the panel's findings say what they say. But
Mr. Drexel,
I think,
did you say that there was a prior disciplinary action here?
Yes, there was.
What was that?
He was criminally convicted of perjury in 1987, and he was interimly suspended criminal conviction suspension. Subsequently, in a disciplinary proceeding, he was given a 2-year actual suspension with credit for the period of his interim suspension. So he was actually suspended for somewhat over 3 years. He was reinstated in 1990.
Thank you.
At any rate, the recommendation of the panel and the board here, and the panel and the board both say that they probably would not have recommended any period of actual suspension except for the fact that he lied to the relator and to the hearing panel, and that in their mind and in accordance with the cases that they cited, that required and justified a period of actual suspension, and that's why that this level of discipline was recommended.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Derryberry, you may take a minute to sum up.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Mr. Drexel has made a point correctly that in my brief in support that I was not objecting to the finding of the court that...
Counsel, once again, talk into the microphone if you want us to hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Points out that I did not object to finding of that I had misrepresented a conversation with Mr. Kantner or that I misrepresented whether or not I had had conversations and discussed certain things with Ms. Moore. When you've been in the practice of law and you have the respect for the system, for the law, for the people, you recognize that when factual issues are presented to the triers of the fact, that at a point, what they decide, what they say this is the fact, becomes the fact, irrespective of what your contrary position may be. I recognize that after a full, fair, I praise the cooperation with Mr. Drexel, with the panel concerning my medical condition, and I mean, I have no complaints about the way anyone treated me or the situation. The panel made a finding. I am accepting it, and I wanted to make it clear that I was not coming here to re-argue what they found. The point that I was wanting to make is that I very consciously did have a strategy that I think to this very day is correct, and that to the extent that I did fail in this 23 work days, actually 35 days, I'm trying to minimize that, I guess, from the time I was hired until I was out of the blue discharged, if I failed to communicate, if the communication attempts that I made or thought that I had failed to cause Ms. Moore to understand, I failed her as an attorney. I failed the profession in not doing that part of what I should have been doing. And I accept that finding. I accept responsibility for that. I am extremely apologetic, albeit it was somewhat late. I did send a letter to Ms. Moore refunding the balance of the retainer, a very sincere apology. The letter is part of the stipulations in the transcript here. I did not intend, do not intend to contest the findings of the panel as to whether it is true or not true that Ms. Moore and I spoke more three times or two times, as she says, nor to deny that she didn't understand. It is simply to say that the two of us were thinking differently under those circumstances. I believe my thoughts and intentions were correct, and I maintain that. I readily admit,
Mr. Derryberry,
that I failed. This wouldn't
over
happen.
Here.
Yes, sir.
Did you make up an invoice that falsely stated that there was a conversation with opposing counsel?
I'm sorry.
Did you make up an invoice that said you had a conversation with opposing counsel when you did not?
My secretary made up an invoice, and she made up the invoice from notes she made, and it did say that. It absolutely did.
Did you tell Relator that you had a conversation with opposing counsel when you had not?
At a point in time, and I answered numerous letters, and I think promptly and candidly and honestly, on a certain day he asked a question that, in my recollection, because I couldn't figure out whether I talked to Mr. Kantner or not had anything to do with the case. Strategically, after I failed to get him and got to thinking of everything put together, I didn't want anyone to have this is a very short period of time on a case that is complex, but it's still what I do, and a client that I had every reason in the world to respect and do my best for. I sent an email to Mr. Drexel in which I believe my intent was to say, like he's saying, why would you? The reason that I had tried to reach Mr. Cantner was to frankly get some help in unraveling all the...
Counsel, I think the question is, did you tell your secretary that you had spoken with Mr. Cantner while she was making up the billing statement?
No, ma'am, I did not. Absolutely did not.
Thank you. We're concluded. Gentlemen, we'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.
Marshal, will you call? Will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.